Okay, well, I'm talking about Sydney Uni as a ruling class institution because, you know, we're here talking about the class struggle. Well, the class struggle always has two sides, so I'm talking about their side. And it's pretty clear these days there's lots of concerns that people have about the increasing managerialism, standardisation, kind of degree factory aspect of universities. It's pretty commonplace worldwide. I found an interesting book called The Slow Professor, Challenging the Culture of Speed in the Academy, which I could relate to being somebody who never produced anything much while I was an academic. And in it, these authors, Maggie Beer and Barbara Siever, critique neoliberalism for creating, in their words, corporate universities where power is transferred from faculty to managers, economic justifications dominate, and the familiar bottom line eclipses pedagogical or intellectual concerns. And I think that's right, but it's not enough. Because while the specific form that it takes may have evolved, the university, especially an elite university like Sydney, has since the 19th century been an outgrowth of capitalism. There was no golden age of the modern university. And conversely, if the needs of capitalism now require a large minority of the working class to have a university degree, this is not because the bosses have suddenly developed an interest in our development as well-rounded human beings. Just they think they need it. Okay, so I want to go back to some of the origins of the capitalist origins of the modern university. And although there are universities across the globe that can trace their history back many centuries, the modern capitalist university is a different beast entirely and a much more recent one. It's developed to meet the needs of profit-making, both ideologically as well as scientifically. And even into the 19th century, the more far-sighted ideologues of capitalism continued to express concern that society, and especially business, was not governed by enough science and instead by too much dogmatism of common sense backed by rule of thumb. And with its origins in 1850, Sydney University reflected this transition to a university more directly trying to meet the needs of capitalism. Now, initially, there was quite a divergence between the university's proponents, the more far-sighted people, if you like, in the ruling class, and the rest of the rich in Sydney. This is what one of the scholarly books about the history of the university, written by people that loved it from the day one, said. The 1850s was an excellent time to found a school or university college. Everyone was interested in education, especially moral education, and the formation of conscience. And what consciences could be more important in the end than those of the young men who would be the nation's future leaders, university students, in other words? According to non-university proponents, however, most successful men in New South Wales, whether in business or the professions, were either uneducated or uncultured or both. Making money seemed enough study in itself, or else it just produced contempt for all forms of knowledge categorised as useless. The universities, in fact, began to garner more widespread respect from the rich when they aided the solution of practical problems. So one of the first examples at Sydney Uni was when Professor John Smith, that was his real name, began to advise the colonial authorities on water supply problems. That was useful. That's the knowledge we want. This is not to say, though, that there was not a thirst for knowledge throughout this period. It just wasn't to be found in the rich. There was a yearning for education and culture, and it was reflected amongst the mass of the population, amongst the working population. It was reflected in schools of arts, mechanic institutes, working men's colleges. By 1900, 50 years after the formation of Sydney Uni, there were well over 1,000 of these basically popular bodies. But the university had no place for them, had no interest in them. Actual education was not what the universities were about. So I want to move on to a section I've entitled Who Pays the Piper Calls the Tune, because this is really how the university has operated. From the outset, some of the rich gave money to Sydney Uni. It would not have survived, really, without the bequest for chairs, colleges, buildings and scholarship chairs. I mean professorships, not the things you're sitting on. Often the money came with strings attached, as did the government money, it must be admitted. The rich in New South Wales, at the time that Sydney Uni was formed and subsequently, and still today, formed a tight ring. At the outbreak of World War I, there were just over 15,000 people. That was 0.67% of all wealth holders, even less than the 1% that we've talked about since Occupy Wall Street. 15,000 people with more than £5,000, and they own 34% of all personal wealth. This is where the donations came from. So let's talk about a few of those donations. One example, CSR, the Colonial Sugar Refinery, one of the main Australian companies dominating the lands of the Pacific in the late 19th and early 20th century. Sydney Uni helped them very much in response for their generosity. They helped them ideologically in particular, setting up various anthropological studies with the support of the Australian government. And popular anthropological works about the islands, together with the ever-present romantic accounts of the South Seas and the church's propaganda about their civilising mission, all these things came together in the university and reinforced the idea that Australians were higher in the evolution of so-called civilised societies than the islanders, and therefore, of course, had a right to exploit them, which is what CSR did mercilessly. See a similar sort of thing as part of the destruction of Aboriginal society in the era of the Aboriginal Protection Board, and particularly in the 20s and 30s, senior Aborigines Protection Board staff were sent to the University of Sydney to study anthropology because it would help, obviously, to enhance their paternalism. And actually, this is not the past. The strings attached to funding are still there. In February 2007, the university acquired a portion of the land that had been granted at its foundation to St John's College, one of those appalling animal house colleges, and I'll come back to them. But they got, in 2007, a portion of land from St John's College because they wanted to develop the Sydney Institute of Health and Medical Research. As a Roman Catholic institution, St John's placed limitations on the type of medical research which could be conducted on the premises, even after they'd sold it off. There were strings attached, and you can imagine what kind of medical research, anything to do with reproduction, basically, women's rights, any of that. A recent 2016 investigation by the ABC exposed another one of these corporate deals. The veterinary faculty and large pet food companies, and those of you who are cat lovers probably should cover your ears at this point, they withheld a whole series of results on harmful cat food products because, of course, they had been tested to protect the corporate sponsors, not to protect the cats. So, but the links to benefactors are not always so direct. Sometimes you can tell that Sydney University is a ruling caste institution just by looking at who sits on the board of directors. Sorry, it's not called the board of directors, that's a bit corporate. It's called the Senate. But it actually is the board of directors and the other undemocratic governing bodies that the university has got. In 2003, former New South Wales Premier Nick Greiner was actually forced to resign his chair at the university's Graduate School of Management because there were protests about his simultaneous chairmanship of British American Tobacco. The current Chancellor, Belinda Hutchinson's links to another even more powerful industry of death have so far caused no such hassles, even though students have protested about them. A week or so ago, students around the country were protesting under the slogan, "Books, not bombs," as the government cuts over $2 billion from higher education while handing out $3.6 billion to defence industry companies. And that slogan was particularly apt at Sydney University, because alongside her Chancellor role, Belinda Hutchinson serves as the board chair of weapons manufacturers, and I don't know how to say their name, Thales, Thales, whatever, Australia. Anyway, weapons manufacturers, and a big one. And this is what she said of her involvement with them. As an advanced manufacturer and service provider, note the lack of any words about weapons. As an advanced manufacturer and service provider, Thales is currently actively contributing to Australia's development as a knowledge and technology-based economy. So I am excited by my new role as chair. It's also worth mentioning in passing that Sydney Uni actually invests directly $4 million in arms manufacturers, mostly Honeywell. But Belinda Hutchinson is not just the corporate face of the weapons industry attached to the university, in fact, the Chancellor of the university. She's also a good example of the corporate university in another way, embodying as she does the chair of a whole range of companies. She's the chair of Future Generation Global Investment Company. She's a non-executive director of AGL Energy, of Australian Philanthropic Services, She was also previously chairman, and that's her word, not mine, chairman of QBE Insurance Group, as well as the director of Telstra, Coles Myer, the TAB, Energy Australia, St Vincent's Health Australia, and the Crane Group. How very collegial. And of course, it's worth mentioning in passing again that higher education is itself a major industry. It's a record export earner. In 2016, higher education earned $21.8 billion as part of the Australian economy. So this is the kind of, you know, the corporate kind of feel-good club that the Sydney University is and has always been. On the other hand, those who are seen to buck the system in some way have routinely been threatened. So, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century, when the university's history professor, George Wood, came out against participation in the Boer War, an attempt was made to dismiss him from his chair. Similarly, when the university's first professor of economics, Robert Irvine, was forced to resign in 1922, ostensibly because his adultery had been brought to the attention of the university authorities. But I think given that he was forced to resign in 1922, there was a sort of anti-socialist wave of hysteria running through Australian society, the Australian ruling class society at that point. I think the reason is much more likely than his adultery, his mildly radical economic views. And in more recent times, in the 21st century, we have seen a concerted campaign, not once but twice, to try to get rid of Professor Jake Lynch because of his support for the Palestinians. Then there's the question of the class struggle. As I said, the class struggle always has two sides, and Alma's section, I'm not going to say much about it because Alma's section is much more talking about the class struggle from the working class's side. But it's worth mentioning that when its students came almost entirely from wealth, Sydney Uni's involvement in the class struggle, it's extended to organised student scabbing. In historian Terry Irving's estimate, at this time the students really were the 1%. He reckons that less than 1% of young men and women between 20 and 24 could enrol, and there were very few bursaries for those who couldn't afford the university's fees. And so these are the people. They saw themselves as the same class. They were the same class as the 1% that provided the generous donations and so on, and they put themselves out there in the class struggle. I am happy to say that in 1913, a group of about 30 Sydney Uni students, while acting as scabs to break an 8-week gas strike, were beaten up outside the Herald building by a gang of working class youths from the slums around the Kent Street gasworks. During the Great Strike of 1917, right from the start, the Sydney Uni students were itching to crack uppity working class heads. And so as early as the 3rd of August, right at the start of the strike, the New South Wales Premier Fuller was able to boast of offers of assistance as scabs from university engineering students. I want to end with one other thing. I mentioned before the university colleges, and I think the Sydney University colleges are quintessentially ruling class institutions. People will probably be familiar with the Red Zone report that came out a few months ago. The authors of the report spent 18 months investigating the vile, violent, sexist behaviour of some of Australia's wealthiest young people. And that behaviour in the colleges at Sydney Uni and other similar elite bodies around the country, that behaviour is not in any way an aberration. The ritual humiliation, put it mildly, of first-year students has been a tradition since the establishment of the institutions at Sydney Uni in particular. And so we can go back, you look at, you know, previous generations. In 1958, newspaper reports tell of first years at the University of Sydney being bashed, chased, tackled and burned with silver nitrate during initiation rituals. In 1965, newspapers reported that University of Sydney college students were forced to run a 4-kilometre steeplechase while other students hit them and pulled their clothes off. Even more horrifying, in 1977, a young woman's body was found on the grounds of St Paul's College. Of course, nothing to do with them. She had been raped and murdered at the same college. Just 5 days after the body was found, four students were who had been accused of gang raping another female student were given a prize by the other male students at St Paul's College. The prize was the Animal Act of the Year trophy, and they meant it as a compliment. And this hasn't gone away. In 2009, it's not just the things that's in the Red Zone report. In 2009, male students at St Paul's College began a Facebook group, as students do. This Facebook group was dedicated to promoting the virtues of rape. Okay, and so this is my last point about Sydney Uni being a ruling class institution. And I want to say these things, we're focusing here on Sydney University, but the same things could be said about every university, particularly the elite ones. And I think the colleges are something special that only the elite universities have. And it's this, that as a ruling class institution, they need to create not just ordinary wage slaves who've just got enough education to do whatever the boss wants you to bloody do. They also need to create their own class, or recreate their own class. And that means for capitalism, daily brutality has to be meted out to the majority of people around the world. Whether it's war, starvation, oppression, exploitation, you name it, they've got to hand it out. And so you think about it, they've got to create their own class anew, again and again. They've got to beat the humanity out of them. To oversee a system like this requires that human empathy be stripped away and that future leaders be trained to make what they like to call the tough decisions. The decisions that actually aren't tough on them but are tough on everyone that comes into contact with them. And so ruling class schools and institutions such as university colleges have historically played this role, and I think Sydney Uni is up there with the best, or should we say worst, of them.
Our next speaker is Rick Coon. Rick is a long-time member of Socialist Alternative and was active as a student at Sydney Uni in the 70s and early 80s. So Rick's going to tell us about some of that.
Hundreds of students in front of on the front lawn of Sydney University, which is in front of the sandstone, very important, quadrangle at Sydney University, a first substantial building constructed there, a symbol of its power. Hundreds of students there, they were there to protest another decision by the university administration not to establish a separate unit that would administer courses in political economy, meeting alternative approaches to the mainstream conservative religion that in our universities and more broadly is known as economics. This mass meeting was at the tail end of the student revolution. Still mass mobilisations, but there had been even larger mass mobilisations during the period of the Vietnam War, where university students, the male students, had both a moral and an immediate interest in protesting against conscription and the war. That movement saw large numbers of students mobilised both at universities across Australia, including Sydney University, but also on the streets as an important element in the mass mobilisations against the war. The origins of one of the predecessor organisations of Socialist Alternative, Resistance, a Trotskyist group that was formed in Sydney, go back to the efforts of John and Jim Percy. John Percy, who died last year, 2 years ago, was a member of Socialist Alternative. So the universities have, in Australia and in many other countries, provided a cadre for revolutionary organisations. Not, sadly enough, a mass cadre, but nevertheless have been a breeding ground for people to engage in radical activity. In 1972, a draft resistor, Michael Matheson, was being driven by a fellow student near the university campus. He stopped at some lights and two cops abandoned their car. They'd been following them, got into the car carrying Matheson and directed the driver to go to the police station. Matheson was a step ahead and suggested that the driver instead go onto the campus, which it did. And despite the fact that the cops had handcuffed Matheson to one of them, that wasn't enough. Large numbers of students mobilised, and Chips McInulty, who worked in the arts workshop, knew where there were bolt cutters. And Matheson was liberated from that arrest. In 1973, there was a mass movement over the introduction of courses in feminism in the Department of Philosophy, and both staff and students played an important role in that campaign. The staff provided an ideological direction. The philosophy department was already run under staff-student control. There was a three-week strike by something like 2,000 staff and students across the university in six different departments, which eventually achieved what the people in political economy a few years later, 3 years later, wanted to achieve with economics. That is, the philosophy department was divided between a general philosophy department, brackets radical, and a traditional and modern philosophy department, brackets reactionary. And that provided something of an inspiration for the political economy movement, although it had been going on for quite a number of years, since the late 1960s, where left-wing staff had wanted to teach alternative kinds of courses about economics, not just microeconomics, macroeconomic mainstream. Now, it was much easier to be a student radical in that period. Much, much easier, because there were a lot of other people who were student radicals. Being involved in the political economy campaign, I remember there were communists involved, both a junior member of staff and also some other communists who were students, although nobody ever asked me to join. Maybe that was a wise decision, but I suspect, given that they didn't sell Tribune either, it was that they had no conception of how to build an organisation. That mass meeting in July 1976 was addressed by a series of different speakers, and then the chair suggested that it might be an idea to march on the Vice-Chancellor's office. There'd already been, the previous year, an occupation of the Vice-Chancellor's office over political economy courses. So we marched over, and some students decided that the fact that the door was shut should not be an obstacle to visiting the Vice-Chancellor's office. And Comrade Martin Hurst, who at various times has been a member of Socialist Alternatives and its predecessor organisations, who is a fairly solid bloke, played a significant role in kicking the door in. The chair, meanwhile, was a bit taken aback by this development because that hadn't been discussed beforehand. But people ignored him. It was me. And Martin having cleared the way, large numbers of students went into the Vice-Chancellor's office and stayed there for a while. But that wasn't the end of the militancy around the introduction of effectively a Department of Political Economy. Later that month, there was a university-wide strike from the 14th to the 26th of July involving about 4,000 students and staff. Eventually, in effect, a Department of Political Economy was established at Sydney University, and it still exists to this day. In fact, I'm visiting there at the moment. It hasn't always been like that, both previously and obviously subsequently to anybody who has been on a university campus for, 10, 20 years? They're not exactly seething with mass activity, places of political ferment. Political activity in a serious radical sense at Sydney Uni only really got going during the Depression. At that stage, as Diane has pointed out, the universities were very much elite institutions, and the idea of radicalism being something amongst the student body was a bit strange. But there were some radicals, people who may have got a bursary, have got a scholarship, you know, the ruling class skimming off bright working class kids, processing them through a ruling class institution so that they could actually play a useful role in society. or other people who are disillusioned between the gap between their aspirations for a better world and what they were getting at the university. So in the early 1930s, especially in Sydney, there was a deep social polarisation. Jack Lang was the premier. There was a movement inside the Labor Party for socialism in our time. That's the same party that's the ALP today, by the way. Not that it was a seriously socialist party, but there were serious socialists inside the party, and that influenced some students who were involved in the socialisation units. Later on during the 1930s, it was communists who were the prominent radicals at Sydney University, but not, again, in large numbers. After the war, the situation changed. Sydney University, like other universities, became much more mass institutions, opened up to kids from non-ruling class backgrounds. And the first layer of people who went to university on that kind of basis was ex-service people, overwhelmingly ex-service men who got Commonwealth scholarships to go to university. A little bit later on, not under a Labor government, but actually under Pig Iron Bob Menzies' Liberal government, Commonwealth scholarships were introduced in order to expand the pool of more highly skilled labour available to the capitalist class. Those communists played a role in a period of pretty low-level struggle in Australian society and on the universities as well. Two large movements are worth noting. In July 1951, a campaign by trainee teachers initiated by communists and the broader Labor Club, in which the communists were an element, sought to get increases in the allowances for trainee teachers, which were being devalued by rapid Korean War inflation. Eric Fry, a communist, moved a motion at a meeting of 600 trainee teachers at the Teachers College at Sydney University. And he wrote later, "As I looked at them," that is, the other students, "I knew that I had to take them all out with me, else I would stand alone to be victimised or driven out of the teaching service. So I spoke with great conviction. I also truly believed in what we were doing." And his conviction obviously paid off, as well as the trainee teachers' concern about their inability to meet their the needs of their lives out of their allowances. The campaign spread, what's more, to other teachers' colleges across New South Wales and eventually extracted an increase in allowances from the state Labor government. Another mobilisation happened in 1955 after a 16-year-old student was hit by a car when trying to cross Parramatta Road, which, if you know Sydney, is one of the main arteries, near the Student Union building. A small group of communists and Labor Club members rapidly issued and distributed a leaflet that called a meeting a few days later to demand a safe road crossing. 2,000 to 3,000 students turned up and blocked Parramatta Road. There were arrests, but a pedestrian crossing was set up, staffed by a cop, very soon after, and eventually traffic lights were introduced. So here, communists played a key role in intervening in a political opportunity to mobilise students and to achieve something important. And I think that there are parallels with the current period in that respect. Period when the levels of social struggle are low, but in which there are opportunities to mobilise other people in achieving demands that serve their own interests. And in those campaigns, it's students who have worked out revolutionary politics that play an extremely important role. That role tended to be submerged during the periods of mass mobilisation, because either the revolutionaries were very few in number, or in the case of the Communist Party, if you are generous in calling them revolutionaries, didn't have much of a clue about how to relate to student radicalism, and in any case their position on the Vietnam War was fairly crap. But under those kinds of circumstances, the existence of a somewhat larger number of revolutionary students could have intensified even further those mass struggles, generalised them into support for a range of other issues and exerted even more pressure. And what we're faced with today is to try and build a larger cadre of students who are prepared to take a lead. Know that going up the right channels is essentially diving into a sewer. Know that mobilising and getting people active is the way to achieve results, not only in the here and now, but also to win people to a wider program of socialist politics.
Thanks, Rick. Then the final speaker is going to be Alma. Alma is currently a worker at Sydney University and has been very active in the resistance by staff there to attacks from university management over the last few years, and has been one of the leaders of industrial action from a rank and file position at Sydney Uni. So, welcome, Alma.
So, in the last 3 years, revenue from international student fees at the University of Sydney has gone from $391 million to $752 million. That's an increase of 92%. And over the past 4 years, international student income at the university has doubled. So more than a third of students are now international students. And higher education, as Diane said, is Australia's third largest export, and to the New South Wales economy, it brings in $10 billion. And for the first time ever in 2016, the fee income from international students in New South Wales universities has surpassed the fee income from domestic students. As the government funding for universities has been gutted over the decades, universities have turned to unashamedly ripping off both international and domestic students and relying on the international student dollar. There's numerous stories of international students' parents getting into different loans or selling their homes overseas in places like China as a way of paying for the student's education, child's education, with the hope of them getting a job and even perhaps a pathway to PR, and this is certainly what the University of Sydney promotes to students. So the reason I'm starting with this is because I think it really summarises everything that's happening in a very quick way at Sydney University, but also universities in general. The reliance of universities on the international student dollar has had a number of flow-on effects. Students are increasingly seen as customers instead of students. Degrees are referred to as products. Education fairs are seen as market fairs, and as a consequence, educators, teachers, and university staff are seen as providers that are more and more forced to meet certain KPIs or even sales targets. So if you work in the student centre, your KPIs would include being able to answer dozens and dozens of inquiries from students in a short amount of time. And if you happen to have the job of working in the recruitment office, you actually have sales targets. So you have a number of students you're supposed to enroll into a degree. So the average student is paying the average international student is paying $29,000 per year for a degree. The degrees vary between 3 and 4 years. And then there's also been an expansion of postgraduate degrees, which a lot of them are completely useless. at UC, they happen to sit in the Faculty of Business, Master of Management, Master of Accounting, Master of HR. Anyway, all that nonsense. It costs around $40,000 a year, and that's not just for international students. There's a lot of postgraduate degrees that are now aimed at domestic students that are costing a similar amount of money. And we all know about the fee help scandal where the university, the Simon Birmingham and obviously Labor before that have expanded domestic students access to basically credit, a way for students to pay for these exorbitantly expensive degrees with the hope of getting a job after and so on. So, because of this lack of funding, because of this reliance on the international student dollar, it means that universities have engaged in intense competition with other universities, both domestically and internationally. So, and I'm not talking about competition to produce the best research, like, although obviously that, research is something that universities do, but in terms of what the senior executive are actually doing is they are competing to recruit the highest number of students from usually overseas countries. So in order to do this, they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars, obviously, into recruitment and admissions, so setting up recruitment centres in Asia and other places, paying agents to help process applications. At UCIT, spending literally billions of dollars on new buildings, so that look excellent in photos. So $1.7 billion has been spent in the last, 7 years, and there's another $700 million planned. So that is a huge amount of money. They've also relaxed admission requirements for courses, and as I mentioned before, created useless new courses like a graduate diploma or a master's where you might pay like $40,000 a year and graduate and start on minimum wage. Okay. The other aspect of this whole situation is that universities are trying to restructure the way they research and deliver the way they deliver research and teaching. So at UCIT, what they want to do is introduce more online units where basically academics are forced to give a lecture that's recorded and then that can be played over and over again for future courses with like no interaction for the students. And anyone who's ever tried to study Math 101 at UCIT would know that there is no place to sit. You're literally in a class of like 300 students. You get basically sitting on the stairs. And if you don't understand what this algebra equation or whatever is, well, too bad. You have to, figure it out yourself because, you're not really there to learn. You're basically there to pay your fees. So, the other thing that they're doing is cutting courses that are not profitable, and people might have heard of the cuts to Sydney College of the Arts, which is basically the art school at UCIT. It happens to be sitting on quite profitable land in Roselle, which the state government might want to open up for development. So that's one of the things that, the university has been doing. So to oversee all of these ruthless changes to education, the university has appointed more and more corporate managers into senior executive positions. So the vice chancellor himself, who's on 1.5 mil a year.
Is that all?
I'm sure that's just the disclosed amount. he's a reverend in the Anglican Church. He's a known homophobe who refused to not only come out in support of marriage equality last year, but wouldn't even receive a staff petition on the matter. And he's been a key proponent of fee deregulation. Dan did a really good introduction, or lowdown, on Belinda Hutchinson, AM. She's a multimillionaire. I tried to Google her net worth, but that's obviously not disclosed either. I'm sure it's been covered up, but what I did find was that her last property sold for $7.5 million. As Diane said, she's an executive board member of Thales, which is a French international manufacturer. So she's on the executive board here in the Australian wing of Thales. And she's been chairman of QB Insurance and also the Salvation Army. The manager at the Faculty of Engineering IT was a former Qantas boss. And it was shortly after his appointment that we heard about psychometric testing being introduced for new staff, new employees at the university, at engineering. So basically there was like a spill and fill happening where they sack staff and they rehire them on lower wages. And it's a no growing tactic within universities. It's a way to get rid of a unionized workforce. Anyway, the thing they introduced was not only did you have to pass your job interview, you also had to do this crazy psychometric test, which was totally scientifically invalid and different research has shown it's useless, but nonetheless, they used it. Needless to say, the drive towards a more profitable Sydney University has naturally meant numerous attacks on the workers as well. So, in general, UCID has been very aggressive towards the staff union there, and this is exactly what has spurred resistance from both staff and students on campus over the past few years. So just quickly a bit about me. I work as an administrator at UCID in the HDR Centre, so it's basically the student centre for postgraduate research students. Who are doing PhDs or masters or whatever, are also totally exploited and ripped off. They basically produce all the publications for the university and get hardly anything in return. I've been there as a full-time worker since 2012, and before that I was a casual and a student as well. So my introduction to union activism was in 2012, when the Vice-Chancellor, the esteemed Vice-Chancellor, sent around a video basically explaining to staff how we needed to downside the massive administration costs that the uni has and frankly get rid of staff who were not pulling their weight. Like, he literally used this language. Shortly after receiving that YouTube video, we were told that the university management had drawn up a hit list of staff, academic staff, who had not been performing in the area of research, i.e. they looked at what they had done for the last 3 years and decided that it wasn't good enough, and so picked the bottom, 200 or so, and decided to put them on a hit list of staff to be sacked, literally. And so staff had no idea that they were even meant to be producing this level of research for the last 3 years. So anyway, so obviously this Orwellian video and this hit list enraged the campus, a campaign began called No Job Cuts to defend the jobs of these academics. They also planned to attack administration staff, but the focus of the campaign was around the academic jobs. So through my union, which is the National Tertiary Education Union, we organized mass rallies on campus that would march through the campus, angrily try to mobilize more students and staff into the campaign, and would end up at the VC's window where we told him exactly what we thought. And the largest of those rallies was 1,500 people. So whilst we didn't have the right to strike, we actually managed to save the majority of those jobs, and the staff that, the less than 12 staff that did lose their jobs, by the end of it had, wanted to leave the university anyway because they fucking hated the place. But so we managed to save a couple hundred jobs. That's pretty good in this climate. The administration wasn't able to get away with all the job cuts they wanted, but they did achieve one thing, and that was to soften us up for the following year, at which point the new enterprise bargaining agreement was to be negotiated. So 2013 was the second campaign that I was involved in. So our agreement had expired, and it was time to fight for a pay rise and better working conditions. The university obviously had something else in mind. They went all out. The offer they gave us was basically the wind back of the entire agreement. They tried to give us a massive pay cut. They tried to strip away all of our sick leave and conditions, leaving the bare minimum. They tried to remove anti-discrimination protections from the agreement. So, you know, those things that say you're not allowed to be discriminated because you're like a woman or gay or something. They actually tried to get rid of that from the agreement. They try to get rid of academic freedom, the list went on. It was basically they went for help for leather. The staff union responded with a strike campaign, and for the first time in a very long time, we set up, we blockaded every entrance to the university, and staff and students banded together to have, to basically stop cars and trucks and other, yeah, people trying to get into the campus. We ended up having 7 days of strike, and every time we had pickets. And we not only had to battle with people trying to enter the university, like trucks who were trying to, you know, deliver goods and stuff. Obviously, the university called the riot police onto campus, and we had to have massive fights as well, like at the picket lines. And one person actually had their leg broken, a student, and another one ended up in hospital. So in this campaign, students played a key role, and yeah, I think it supports what Rick and Diane said before about the potential for students on campuses to be radical. The campaign went into almost a year, and because the university was failing to attempt, was failing in its attempt to convince workers why this new agreement was excellent and why they were broke, they actually had to go to the extreme length of hiring a PR company to convince people why they should give up all their sick leave and get this pay cut, because, you know, the university was broke, even though there was, like, cranes everywhere, construction sites everywhere, like, billions of dollars poured into construction. No, they were like, no, we can't afford a pay rise. They consistently sent emails to people telling them how, despite what the union's saying, all lectures are going ahead, and, like, to students that, don't be scared of people on the picket lines. You have a right to come to campus. Anyway, all of this failed. Okay, I better hurry up. So, I think by now people are probably wondering, why is it that UCIB has managed to have all these campaigns so far that involve hundreds and actually thousands of staff overall over the years, whilst similar attacks are happening in other universities, and it's maybe not necessarily happening on the same scale. So I think it's worth quickly looking at the NTU branch at UCIB. Well, I think firstly, it is the stuff that Diane and Rick said, that UC does have a history of activism, and this is, it's just something that is kind of in the water. Like, people are, people expect to do things and protest when there's an injustice. But I think also it does help that at UC, everyone just hates the administration. And since 2012, a couple of hundred activists were born out of the campaign, out of the gross injustice of trying to sack people for, you know, performance that they didn't even know that they were supposed to be doing 3 years ago. Like, people just were furious. And out of that, we managed to get a couple of hundred people to commit to long-term union activity. So in the university has between 6,000 and 8,000 staff, and around 2,000 members. 2,000 people are NTU members. There's also the CPSU, but they have much lower coverage. And just over 1,000 of the members of the union are academics, and the rest are general staff like myself. So this includes administrators, librarians, research assistants, psychologists, maintenance workers, and IT workers, to name a few. So it's really a mixed bunch at UC. So in practice, in terms of when we run campaigns, we have a good kind of system going on where we have this campaign committee of roughly 200 people who are signed up to do things on campus, things like sticking up posters, holding a local meeting in their area, doing leafleting before 9 a.m., and making phone calls to other members to get them to go out on strike or come to a protest when things are happening. So the 2012 and 2013 experiences meant that we were well-placed going into last year's EBA negotiations. So last year, because our agreement had expired, it was time to once again negotiate a new agreement. And the university, realizing the mistake they made in 2013, decided to, instead of attacking everything in the agreement, to focus on a few things. So their main focus were on trying to expand the rights to advertise teaching-only positions, which is a big attack on academics, and also the pay rise. So they were basically wanting to give us a pay cut. The problem this time, though, was that it was happening in the context of Murdoch University. So it meant that whilst the union did have the infrastructure and had the potential to organise, and it certainly did, and I'll quickly go over some of the things we did, the union leadership kind of dragged its feet in response. So we had the initial log of claims, which is basically a list of demands of what we want for the agreement, and one of the major debates we had was about what to demand in terms of the pay rise. So those on the left who thought we should obviously always have a big claim pursued that argument, and however the union bureaucracy was basically saying no, the average pay rises at 2.5%, so we can't be too radical. Anyway, this was part of the way they were softening us up to not actually fight. The second debate that was major was about whether or not to go on strike. It was basically that, you know, instead of striking like we did in 2013, why don't we do things like open day or email signatures or, you know, like wear T-shirts. Anyway, this was ludicrous, and the majority of members didn't actually think that was, yeah, going to win, so luckily. So in the end, we had several meetings of hundreds of members that voted for a strike on the 13th of September. And just a week before this happened, 10 days before it happened, the Murdoch decision was handed out, which had an electrifying, in a bad way, electrifying effect on the whole sector. It meant that people, if people don't know, just quickly, Murdoch meant that the university administration basically applied to terminate the agreement, and overnight, you know, throwing out all the conditions that Murdoch staff had, threatening everything people had fought for a long time. So this basically scared every single trade unionist in the higher education sector that this could happen to Sydney Uni as well. It also emboldened the university administration. So a week before the strike, the university had been trying very, very hard to get the strike called off by, you know, calling the union members, telling them they have updated their pay offer and all this stuff, and like throwing in this and that to get them to call off the strike. But it didn't work. Because that didn't work, they decided to test the waters with like a push poll. So they basically sent an email. I was sitting in a union meeting of 200 members planning the strike next week when suddenly someone from the audience called out, oh, hey, we just got an email from the VC basically saying they're planning to go to like a non-union ballot. And this had the effect of completely energizing the entire room because people were so furious that the university would dare to do this. So they announced this push poll, which was basically a vote of all staff on whether or not they would be willing to go to a non-union ballot. Anyway, immediately we started organizing to defeat this push poll. Within less than 36 hours, we defeated it, two-thirds to a third, which was an amazing effort. The strike went ahead, and the 24-hour strike went ahead, and again, we had a really good mobilization on campus. We shut down the campus and turned away cars. At one picket, we recruited 10 members, just one picket alone. Within a couple of hours, we recruited 10 members. And then the day after the strike, we resolved to go out for another 48 hours. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. Because like I said, although we had this excellent campaign and lots of potential for fighting, and the thing to be doing in the context of Murdoch was to be fighting, the union leaders didn't think that was the way forward. So they basically went on a campaign of convincing members to accept the latest pay offer, which was basically a pay cut. And they used the fear-mongering around Murdoch to wind up the campaign. At the final vote that we had, we managed to have a third of the room vote to continue the fight, whilst two-thirds two-thirds voted to settle. So we lost the debate. However, we managed to convince a decent group of people in the context of all the things I've said in a very hostile environment that they should keep striking for their rights. So I think that in itself is an achievement. So to conclude, because I'm going way over time, I think that there's a few things we can draw from Sydney University, but also the modern university in general. The first thing is that struggle is possible. Given the history of a place like UC, that it's a ruling class institution that produces ruling class ideas, and the new rulers, where, you know, it's literally the epitome of polite society, where disagreeing is, like, frowned upon, like, to the point that the Vice-Chancellor is actually producing a position paper called Disagreeing Well. Like, and there's a cultural task force at UCIT to basically teach people how they can politely disagree with each other. So in all this context, to have people at picket lines, calling out scabs, turning away trucks, fighting off the New South Wales riot police, it's just something I never imagined, but it just shows it's possible because workers and students are under attack in the modern university and we have no choice but to resist. Second lesson, obviously, is that striking wins. The biggest victories we've ever had and the most members we've ever recruited were the times we went on strike. So in 2013, we took 7 days of industrial action and we recruited like 400 members or something. And then in this year, with just one strike, we recruited like 200 members. So imagine if we had kept going. The third and final lesson is that the way to respond to hostile moves by the administration is not to, sit back and, like, roll over and die. It's actually to organize and fight. And as I said before, even when you don't have the right to strike right now, it's possible to organize mass rallies and even just have people feel confident in their collective power and organizing, as was shown with the No Job Cuts campaign. So I guess my final lesson is that, at the modern university, despite all the attacks on students and workers, if you don't fight, you lose.